Hello, everyone, and welcome to this edition of Next Witness, Please. We're a podcast that decodes legal jargon into understandable everyday terms for just regular folks. Our goal is to build understanding about the law and our legal systems. I'm retired Judge Tom Hodson, and I'm joined by my colleague, friend, and co-host, retired Judge Gail Williams Byers. And today we're going to delve into and explain pre-sentence investigations and pre-sentence reports in criminal cases. Judge Gail, you ready to roll?
I am ready to roll. And how about you? Are you?
I am. And so let me give our listeners just a little background so we make sure that everybody is at the same starting point. If a criminal defendant is found guilty either by a jury or by the judge, there is then a period of time between the time that the guilty verdict comes in and the time that the judge imposes sentence. Now, that's the norm. Sometimes there are mandatory sentences, and the judge would then sentence somebody right away after the jury verdict. But there's usually a number of days or weeks, depending on the severity of the case, between the time the verdict is rendered and the time that the judge pronounces sentence. Now, the important part of that sentence is the judge pronounces sentence, not the jury. The jury only recommends in certain cases, like death penalty cases, but it's a recommendation. The judge is always the one who pronounces the sentence. Now, to help the judge, there are reports done called pre-sentence reports. And we'll get to what's in the report in a bit. But the report is a culmination of a pre-sentence investigation. And that's usually done by the probation department of the court or some court officer that's designated to conduct that kind of investigation. So, Judge Gail, talk a little bit about with me what was in a pre-sentence investigation for you. You know, we're in the Trump trial now. We're at the point between the guilty verdicts and the 34 felony counts and sentencing, which is scheduled for July 14th. So people are aware that a pre-sentence investigation is going on, but they don't know what it is and what it entails.
Let's
break it down for them.
Absolutely. And here's what I'll also say, and I didn't want to cut you off, but I did want to say also pre-sentence investigation reports can be ordered, not just when a jury or the judge finds a defendant guilty, but sometimes the court can order them when there's a plea to a particular charge.
You're right.
But before there's a sentence. And the purpose of that investigation, which then becomes a report. So a pre-sentence investigation report is generated because it provides some intelligence and some guidance and some information to the court, not necessarily to dictate or even necessarily to shape the court's decisions, but to inform the court's decision making. So for me,
to help the judge.
To help the judge, perhaps even to better understand contours of the case and even the defendant or other parties before a final sentence or judgment is determined. So it's an opportunity for the defendant, for example, and I had this happen many times. It was an opportunity for defendants to provide me with some kind of insight about who they were, what their background was. Sometimes it gave me a bit of an understanding of why or how they ended up in the predicaments or circumstances or situations they were in. Sometimes these explanations reached all the way back to childhood. And if you could see how someone's childhood was maybe dysfunctional or how it was impacted or what was happening, it often fed into how they became a young adult and then an adult who sometimes acted out in certain ways. It gave me the opportunity to understand if they had any prior criminal engagements, even if it didn't result in convictions. But if they had other arrests,
yeah. Stop that was recorded.
Absolutely. Anything else that might have caused them to intersect with law enforcement or the justice system, that too helps me to sometimes understand the broader scope of things. So if you can think of, you know, the case and the individuals who are a part of that case as being kind of a big puzzle, and if the judge is approaching it as objectively as they should be, then you don't know what puzzle pieces go where. You don't even know if there are puzzle pieces that are missing. You have no idea what you may or may not be looking at. You don't even know what the picture is. And so you're using every step of the court process, and with the pre-sentence investigation portion being one of the last steps, you're using that as a way to kind of fit these pieces together to at least get a better understanding of the picture. Now, the picture doesn't dictate, again, how you ultimately sentence or how you respond, but it does sometimes provide you that aha moment, like, oh, now I get it or I understand it. And so this is the time when the defendant talks directly to probation. That's what an interview is. It's called a pre-sentence investigation interview. So the defendant actually sits down, and sometimes there are very structured questions that are asked of the defendant because there's certain information that the probation officer is trying to understand or trying to obtain. And then sometimes the conversation becomes really organic. And so information just kind of pours out, but it's really beneficial information because, again, it helps to shape or round out that conversation and give the court some perspective. If you've got a defendant who may be struggling with a mental illness or a challenge with drug abuse, this is a really good time and opportunity to get a good understanding of when those occurrences, when they began, and maybe what some of the triggers were or when the onsets were, and what, again, how that may correspond to some other law enforcement involvement. So if you have someone who's been maybe in and out of jail or frequently arrested and constantly having issues with the court system, you might want to trace that and see if there's any overlay with, well, when did the drug abuse begin? And, you know, when were you first diagnosed with whatever, fill in the blank, schizophrenia, bipolar, severe depression. If you have someone who's perhaps a veteran of the armed services, you might want to find out when they were discharged and what their history of military service looked like. Were they active? Were they sent into war zones? Did they receive forms of treatment? Were they traumatized? And after they've returned home, did they then develop a pattern of constant engagement with law enforcement after they return home? Because those things may provide correlations.
Let me jump in here. Also, the interviews can be quite extensive and quite long. But let's again put this back in the context of the Trump case, just as a point of understanding for people. In the Trump case, he did his interview virtually, not in person. Most of them are face-to-face interviews, so you can read all kinds of body language and nonverbals and everything else.
And involved drug testing on site.
But also, he had his attorney with him, and that's not the norm. The norm is that the defendant, once is convicted or entered a plea of guilty, they appear by themselves in front of the probation officer. And it's no wonder that interview was so brief. You talk about what is sort of organic about the interview, and that is the conversation between the probation officer and the defendant. Obviously, in the Trump case, that was limited and structured with his attorney being present. But that organic part of the conversation, in most cases, is the most important part of that part of the investigation.
You're so right. And that's, I think, the downside in this instance of having an interview conducted, you know, first virtually. I understand that perhaps 4, maybe even 5 years ago, when we were all engaged in a global pandemic, there may have been more of a need for health and safety reasons to conduct interviews virtually, but those are not the same issues that exist right now. So no. I'm struggling to understand the permission or the permissiveness behind that. Because remember, for every rule or every normal course of action that is now becoming abnormal, every other defendant is and should, rightfully should, wonder why these rules are not being reimagined for them, why they are not being, you know, either bent or rewritten for them. And you're absolutely right. I don't know that I'd ever granted an opportunity for a defense attorney to attend a PSI interview with a defendant. Now, if it were perhaps a specialty docket where we were talking about treatment of some sort.
Or if somebody was under some severe disability.
Absolutely. Then the defense attorney would certainly be invited to continue to participate, because those tend to be long-term or longer-term where we're constantly monitoring behavior. But when we're talking about pre-sentencing, there's a reason why the pre is there, because it's before sentencing. And I think also the court loses the benefit of candor, because when you have those interviews with probation, you are able, or what I, in my experience, is probation has been able to really obtain some really candid insights, remarks, and information from defendants where they're not being kind of sharp elbowed or kicked under the table or cautioned or even, you know, motioned or notioned by their attorney to answer, not answer, or respond in a certain way. And that, I don't think, of any benefit to the defendant. And I certainly think actually it harms them, because the court never really gets to the aha moment by having that kind of interference run for the defendant.
There also is an opportunity for the probation officer or the person conducting the pre-sentence investigation to check and corroborate certain things. For example, the probation officer may be asking the defendant how many, if they own firearms, and if so, how many and what kind? Because if you're a convicted felon in almost all states that I know of and the federal system, you're not permitted to own or have in your possession a firearm. Now, what the investigator can do is ask the defendant to tell them how many firearms they have, and then they can cross-reference that to records to see if the defendant's being honest, which is another part of the investigation to test the credibility and the veracity of the defendant. Another area would be, do you hold any liquor licenses? And both mm-hmm. of these came up in the Trump case. He does own firearms, and he or his closely held corporations do hold liquor licenses. Liquor licenses in most states, and certainly in the state of New York, you cannot hold a liquor license to sell liquor if you are a convicted felon. So some of the questions are open-ended And some of them are to get information that can be cross-referenced with other records to, again, test the veracity of the defendant.
And you're absolutely correct with regard to that, as well as the entire process. And I've mentioned this before. Not only are you testing that, but you have probation officers who can also, when you are brought into the office, they can require on-site drug testing. They can require, because they can ask you to declare if you use any illegal substances or drugs, or to declare any medications that you may be on. And again, as an effort to test the veracity of that, you can be
and
required.
Then comes out the pee cup.
That's right. You can right. You can take a pee cup and, my gosh, then, the man finds out that he's pregnant because he comes in with because it's not uncommon to try to game the system. And, bringing in adulterated samples is not terribly uncommon. But again, this goes to your point of testing the veracity of the defendant. And one thing I think, and maybe you'll share this sentiment with me, because I've heard this comment used over and over and over again as it relates to the pending trials of Mr. Trump, which is, he's been referred to frequently as a convicted felon. And although he's been found guilty, I've always learned that a conviction's not a conviction until there's a sentence. And so he's certainly been found guilty.
That's legally correct.
He's been found guilty. Correct. He's going to be formally convicted once he is sentenced, because there can be some things that happen between now and sentencing. Don't be surprised if the defense attorney files motions to vacate the jury's guilty verdicts. And these can be voluminous motions, and they could go nowhere, but it's an effort to preserve the record, perhaps for appeal. But stranger things have happened, and guilty findings or pleas of guilt or other things have absolutely been overturned before a person is sentenced, thereby negating the finding of guilt and also negating the potential for a conviction. So they are never formally convicted.
We've already had Judge Mershon alerting the parties that there was a Facebook post allegedly saying what the verdict was before the verdict was rendered, allegedly from a cousin of one of the jurors. But the judge said, here, attorneys, investigate this. And so far, that seems to be going nowhere. But that's an example of what can happen between the time of the verdict being rendered and the time of sentencing. So this is a critical time. People may think that nothing's going on, but a lot is happening here during this period of time.
Oh, sure thing. You can have these attorneys come in with, a motion that looks like the Book of Job, all based on a Facebook post, and insisting that, it is just as credible as the Book of Job, and insisting that because of that, all 34 verdicts must be overturned and the court must vacate them, and they must now grant what's called a JNOV, or judgment notwithstanding the verdict, because somehow, a juror has defied the court's order to not discuss this case with anyone while the case is pending. And that clearly didn't happen. And here, Facebook is this provides the underpinning and the factual basis for this. Any number of things can happen. They can insist on a hearing on it. And that could either delay things or it could upend things. And so I don't know that anything should be considered a foregone conclusion until it happens.
Judge Gale, we've been focusing on the pre-sentence investigation portion where the probation officer, the court officer assigned to do the investigation, talks to the defendant directly. However, a huge part of a pre-sentence investigation, in the normal case, a case such as robbery or burglary or rape or sexual assault, even murder or attempted murder, are the victims' statements and the statements of victims' relatives or people associated with the victim in case of a murder. Victim impact statements are a huge part of that investigation, and they're critical in how the probation officer goes about obtaining those.
Oh, yes. And, you know, this is a particularly interesting case that we're kind of wrapping this concept around, because to identify the victim, I'm sure that the state would say, yeah, the victim is the state of New York, and that there were kind of ancillary, you know, individuals who provided support to the victim, such as, you know, perhaps Ms. Daniels and Mr. Cohen, who could provide impact statements. But when you do have direct victims, for example, in the cases that you've just described,
the Jane Smiths and the John Does,
oh my gosh,
of the world,
those victim impact statements are often so powerful that, and I think that many courts offer a few options. First of all, yes, it is, I think, the duty of the probation officer to reach out to, and as well as the prosecution, to maintain contact with, reach out to, and to ensure that the victim is aware that they have an opportunity to be heard by the court, that they can deliver a statement that is either prepared or not. There's often no formality to it. There's no outline. There's no standard. They're often, you know, not, courts don't generally impose time limits, although, again, depending on the kinds of cases, they are frequently so emotional and emotion-filled that participants and victims don't really have the emotional bandwidth to be before the court, especially with the defendant being right there in the court. They don't generally possess the bandwidth. And so when you have victim impact statements, they can either be delivered to the probation office and made a part of the reporting record, or those victims can be invited to court to read them into the record aloud when the court calls for them. Each option is equally powerful.
They're equally powerful, and part of what the judge is required to consider. Victims have rights, and they have the right to be heard, even if they did not testify at the trial. And that occurs occasionally. But they do have the right to be heard, and families of victims have
yes.
the right to be heard. And sometimes that is, I've noticed that in domestic violence cases, where we may have a woman in most cases who is really battered, but has the syndrome that can't come to grips with it. Family members will come in and really tell you the impact of what's gone on.
Or family members will come in and they will tell you the actual experiences of what their loved one has gone through that they themselves or the loved one themselves will not directly disclose to the court. And that could be for a number of reasons. Either, you know, they're still emotionally tethered to the defendant. They may be fearful. They may be ashamed. They may struggle with other challenges, and which could be anything from addiction to mental illness to both. And therefore alerting the court in this instance, as to the behavior or the engagement of the defendant's behavior against that particular victim can really be eye-opening for a judge. For example, consider someone who comes in and they're a parent and they are able to explain to the court that they saw their child with black eyes regularly, or, you know, they know that their child is not that clumsy, but they were constantly, you know, in, you know, had slings, or, you know, were always sore or frequently complaining about having, you know, fallen or being hurt. These are what you understand and know to be very uncommon or uncharacteristic, but this behavior, this only started happening once they were keeping company with the defendant. And the defendant perhaps was, you know, very cavalier about the way that they treated the victim. So much so that maybe, you know, at some point there was even a disclosure that that's, yes, the nature of the relationship. And maybe the victim's too afraid to leave, but the family now becomes aware of it. They can come in and they can tell the court, because this isn't testimony. And that's another thing we want folks to
there's
understand.
No examination of it. There's nobody, no cross-examination.
Right. Nobody's going to cross-examine them. Nobody's going to say, you know, but you weren't there, or you didn't see it, or you have no idea, or maybe your kid just did become clumsy. This is, they can talk about what they suspect. They can talk about what they know. They can talk about how they feel. They can even ask the court for certain outcomes. It doesn't mean that the court is going to adopt it and rubber stamp it wholesale. But when we talk about that idea of giving people voice and providing them that access to justice, which says your voice is your opportunity to be heard, you want your day in court. So if you insist on having your day in court, this becomes, for so many, their day in court. This is their opportunity to make the court understand what it is that they're experiencing. Judge Tom, I'll tell you real quickly, I had a case which I'll never forget. And I think you might remember this one. It was a situation where there were neighbors. And
oh, yeah. I remember
and,
that.
And this one man just terrorized his neighbor for years and years. And, you know, at the sentencing, the victim actually wrote a multi-page victim impact statement. And I think one of the things that hit me the hardest was listening to a victim impact statement that began with, "I did not have faith in the justice system because I've been to this court about my neighbor so many times before." It was something to that effect. And so, and although this was, you know, my first time engaging this case, it wasn't the court's first time. So that meant my predecessor had handled these same individuals in these same positions, with the same defendant being the defendant, the same victim being the victim, many, many times before. And the history of it was a fine in court costs, a fine in court costs, which only resulted in more and more and more traumatic, horrible behavior. And the first thing the victim said was basically, "I don't have any faith in this system, but I'm going to come here anyway. And I'm going to tell you all about what happened. And I'm going to do this because, I guess, because you asked me for this statement. And I'm just going to tell you the whole history of it." And having learned the history of the case or learned the situation, I think the thing that bothered me, again, more than anything as a judge, was the fact that there was someone standing there in court as a victim, now a victim multiple times over, who clearly articulated, "Yeah, I just don't think you guys are going to do anything. And this person is going to be left to terrorize me."
Yeah. And those things are not only emotional, but they trigger some creative sentencing sometimes by judges. I don't want to take a lot of time on this, but just give me about two sentences of what you ended up doing to this guy as a result of this.
Well, he had already pled guilty. I sentenced him to a term of incarceration, so I sent him to jail, but I suspended that. But more than anything, I made him sit out on a very, very busy corner intersection in the city and hold a sign that I think was very reflective of his behavior. It talked about how he wasn't tolerant, that he terrorized his neighbor, that it wasn't reflective of community standards, and that he should be embarrassed. And he said, "I ruined his life," but I tell you what, I never saw him again in court.
and the victim never had to come back either.
I think her faith is renewed.
that's another thing. We talked about victims of crime, but also the investigation is the time for the defense to give information to the probation officer. We've touched on this briefly, but the defense can give names of people to talk with, doctors, counselors, drug rehab people.
Character
references, any number of people who might stand up for the defendant or speak in favor of the defendant to counterbalance the victim statement. So this is not all one-sided. The probation officer has the opportunity and should go out and interview the people that the defense gives that officer to interview as well.
Oh, absolutely. And after all, it is an investigation. And so investigations should be thorough. They should be objective. They should be complete. They should be designed to provide a broad idea and spectrum to the judge, the decision maker. And, you know, not to sound too tongue-in-cheek about it, but, you know, this is, probably about the time when the defendant is maybe 1 to 3 Sundays into attending their new church. So you'll probably get the new pastor's, name and contact information. Because that of course, generally bodes, if not well, it's skews positive.
My court drove more people to church than any pastor, I guarantee you.
Exactly.
Now, how long they stayed there, that's a whole different issue.
Like I said, you're probably somewhere between 1 and 3 Sundays into your new church family. And so probably still the rounds, introducing yourself and not on a first name basis with everybody, but you started going. And so you're going to get some points for having found a church home and a pastor who, or a priest or,
whatever,
or a faith leader who you want to show up. Even if they just show up and sit in the back because they don't have anything to say because they're still getting to know you. Then so be it. And here we can also be candid. Okay. For the more serious offenses, I don't think that priest-penitent relationship is designed to keep a defendant out of prison as much as it is to perhaps create some kind of support system when they do go to prison, because support systems are still important even for those who are incarcerated. So if you are facing a mandatory jail term, you're going to go to prison no matter what. So your pastor or your faith leader is not going to, their presence won't allow you to escape that, but it will be important that, perhaps someone sends you cards or they send you words of encouragement or, they encourage you to start a prison ministry. I don't know, but whatever it is, you'll have that support system both while you're there and potentially, hopefully, if you are ever released, so that we can rely on the fact that you are less likely to reoffend once you
now these. Released. These pre-sentence investigations are reduced to writing and delivered to the judge. Now, at least in mine, Judge, and I would imagine in yours, the probation officer does not make a recommendation. The probation officer just lists all of the information that was gathered and at most says this person is eligible for probation or this person is eligible for release, but they do not make a recommendation. But this is a fairly substantial written document that's delivered to the court itself.
Generally, you are absolutely correct. Now, I have seen in some instances, some limited instances, where the defendant is facing an offense that may be perceived as fairly minor. And for whatever reason, the court wants or needs additional information because of their history of some sort. And has set the matter for sentencing. And therefore, inside of that, the probation department kind of lists what they believe not only is are the recommendations, but the services that can be offered to help respond to the defendant's behavior. So if this is a situation where perhaps the defendant has been charged with a matter involving alcoholism, maybe the probation department has certain resources that it recommends, but that those resources would only be available if the defendant is placed on probation, because if they're incarcerated,
drug addiction is correct. Another one.
Yeah. And so, and so in those instances, you could have, and what I'll also note as an aside is that once this report is prepared, the report is made available for review to the defense, and it's also made available to review to the prosecution. Now,
but that's not mandatory.
It is not.
That's not mandatory.
It's absolutely not mandatory.
Report to the judge. Now, most judges, as you mentioned, think it's only fair to let both sides see what has transpired during the investigation. And I can't remember a time that I did not, but it's not mandatory.
Absolutely. And sometimes if you have, lazy attorneys on either side who, don't really put in the effort to make reasonable recommendations for case outcomes, they may actually be relying on the probation department to suggest something that they could merely say, "Judge, we just would ask you to adopt it. Just adopt whatever probation says, as long as it's not so harsh." Especially if you're the defense, you want the court to adopt it as long as it's not too harsh as against the defendant. And if it is too harsh, you're going to be asking for adoption with, of course, some things being excised out. That has happened. I have seen that happen. But you're absolutely right. When we think about these reports and there being no requirement to share it with one side or another, but if you do decide to share the report, then the court should, of course, exercise objectivity in sharing it with both the prosecution and the defense, especially also if there are supplemental materials that are being relied upon in the report. For example, if there's a mental health evaluation, or if there's a substance abuse evaluation or an assessment that is supplemental to any interview that the probation department has completed, that information is absolutely necessary for the court to understand and to make a determination as to what they should do with this defendant, but also for the state and for the defense to understand what the court's rationale is and all of the information that it considered in an effort to frame an appropriate sentence, because the court's going to make what are called findings of fact, conclusions of law, and they're going to pronounce a sentence having relied upon that. And so to have that information kind of synthesized in one place is extremely helpful.
I should also note that even if the judge provides these to the parties, to the plaintiff and to the prosecution and to the defense, they are not public record. These do not go into the file. They're not filed as part of the case. They're solely for the judge's use and the judge's discretion to allow the parties to view them. So a member of the public or a member of the media, you're out of luck on this one. You can't get a copy.
And sometimes the information is HIPAA protected, right? If you've got a certain kind of evaluation in there that's got some really sensitive information, it shouldn't be released to the public. I mean, who wants their mental health evaluation kind of displayed across the front page of the paper the next day? That's inappropriate.
So let's go back to the Trump case to wind this up, because I know you're on a time crunch today, Judge Gale. So let's talk a little bit about this. Trump was convicted of 34 or found guilty of 34 counts of what in New York is an e-felony. Felonies are usually divided sometimes by letter, sometimes by number as to the degree of felony, but an e-felony in New York is a low-level felony case. So some factors that may be good for President Trump for probation is the fact that it's a low-level case. He's a first-time offender. Those are factors in his favor.
And that is nonviolent. It's a low-level, nonviolent.
That's right. And that there's no person, singular person, as a victim of this case. All of those are factors in his favor that probably will be in the pre-sentence report. Against him, the fact that he violated the gag order 10 times, that he was found in criminal contempt, that he has continued to talk about the case in a negative fashion, even after the verdict was rendered. All those would be reported on the other side. Now, the judge will do a whole program on sentencing, but the judge in this case has several choices. One is called in New York a conditional discharge, which in many places it's a suspended sentence where you sentence somebody to 6 months or a year in prison, but you suspend it. You say you don't have to go if you do these things, A, B, and C. And if you do A, B, and C, then you don't have to go to jail. If you fail to do A, B, and C, or if you violate A, B, and C, then you'll go to jail for what I've sentenced you to. There's straight probation, and then there's jail, and there's home confinement. All of those things, though, will be considered in a pre-sentence investigation, wouldn't you think?
Absolutely. And I also think there are additional factors that the court will balance when determining what type of sentence, as you outlined. There's certainly the strong consideration for the fact that the defendant is no longer domiciled in the state where this event has taken place. And so although they may own property there, if the defendant has not shown contriteness, a willingness to modify or change their behavior, to, you know, show regret or apology,
to even show remorse,
right? It seems, it would then seem likely that any form of oversight, such as probation, might result in simply setting the defendant up for failure, and that they are not likely to comply. And so let's assume arguendo that that is the case, and that they are on a term of, and essentially you can think of probation as essentially you serving your term in the community, you serving your sentence in the community, community control. And so if it's not likely that the defendant will comply with community control, but is no longer domiciled in the state of New York, but is domiciled in the state of Florida, then the court may anticipate extradition challenges. Because even though New York has the jurisdiction over the case, they will lack what's called in personam jurisdiction, or jurisdiction over the person, because the person isn't there anymore. And so that may present its own challenges just to ensure accountability long term. And that is certainly something I think the court might take into consideration when, again, considering all of those factors and deciding, you know, what is the best response here, similar to what you've outlined, and also deciding how best to proceed under the circumstances.
Well, we have a lot coming up in the next few weeks. We're coming up next week on the end of the U.S. Supreme Court term with a couple of big cases out there for you and I to talk about. And then coming up July 14th, the big sentencing that we've just talked about, the pre-sentence investigation about. Judge Merchan is to sentence former President Trump on July 14th.
So I thought it was July 11th, but July 14th it is then.
I think it's July 14th. I will double check. It's either July 11th or July 14th. All right.
I tell you, we'll just keep an eye out for all of those days, right?
But we've got a lot to talk about in the next couple of weeks. So we'll be back at you and talk with you.
Indeed. We are looking forward to reconvening and talking about all that's happening, not just in this case, but in all kinds of cases that are going on, and particularly the rampant activity at the U.S. Supreme Court. There's a lot for us to keep our eyes peeled about over there.
Lot to dig into. Mm-hmm. We want to thank you for listening to this episode of Next Witness, Please. You can subscribe to Next Witness, Please at any of your favorite podcast outlets, specifically iTunes, Spotify, Amazon Music Podcasts, Audible, and the NPR Podcast Directory, or, as I mentioned, your favorite podcast outlet. Next Witness, Please is produced through the auspices of WOUB Public Media. Colin Cameron is our co-producer and our audio engineer. Judge Gale and I will be back soon, we hope next week, to give you more insights into what's going on and probably target the Supreme Court next week. Wouldn't you think, Judge Gale?
I think that's a great way to bring in next week's episode, is to talk about what's happening over in that big building in Washington, D.C.
We thank you again for listening, and have a good day, everyone.
Take care.